Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
A concert master from Superior. And a concert master currently in Superior. Prepare to perform together at Lucius Woods. Plus,
I'm sick of these guys waving the Confederate flag around.
A local writer discovers the truth of his Confederate roots.
I've got as much right to wave that flag as anyone, but I reject it.
All that after this.
Guys waving the Confederate flag around.
A local writer discovers the truth of his Confederate roots.
I've got as much right to wave that flag as anyone, but I reject it.
But first, a concert master from Superior and a concert master currently in Superior. Prepare to perform together at Lucius Woods. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Classical music fans are familiar with the trio, often of violin, cello, and piano, but what do you call a performance of two concert masters and a special guest stride pianist? We'll just call it good music, and it's happening tomorrow at Lucius Woods in Solon Springs. They'll perform everything from pops to classic violin barn burners to ragtime stride piano. But don't let me try to describe it. We're joined by the two concert masters themselves, speaking from Superior. Aaron Aldrich of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra and Deanne Letourneau of the Las Vegas Philharmonic. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks for having us.
Well, we've done this before. We had you on a couple years ago, I think it was, but that was a period that was before pandemic. Anybody remember that?
No. It's the hoping and wishing for it to go back to normal.
Right. So as testament of that unremembered past, I think we can call it, we don't have a recording of that. We looked through the WPR archives, and back then we called the show Hear Me Out. We have since changed the name to Simply Superior, but it doesn't exist in either of those archives.
Mm. We'll call these the lost recordings.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to leave it at that. And you know what? That's great. That makes them even more mythical. We are speaking with Aaron Aldrich and Deanne Letourneau. Aaron is the concertmaster of the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, and I want to get to the word concertmaster in a minute. And Deanne is the concertmaster of the Las Vegas Philharmonic, and both are intimately connected to Superior. Aaron is a professor of music at UWS, University of Wisconsin-Superior, and Deanne grew up here and went to Superior High School and UWS also. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. South Ender.
So I want to start out by asking if concertmaster is still the right term in this day of reevaluations of everything from pronouns to human conditions such as homelessness. Concertmaster, it's got master in it. It certainly doesn't have the word mistress. Is that something that we should still be saying?
You know, for me, I prefer master over mistress. You know? For a couple of reasons, but I think that concertmaster is still pretty relevant, I think. What do you think, Aaron?
I agree, and it's actually the point that Robin brought up. I didn't think of it in that context. I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is it's concertmaster. You know, I think of it in terms of gender roles, and for me, my preference is for there not to be a distinguishing factor of that. But it's certainly an interesting conversation.
And as you say that, I realize that if there is a debate, and I'm sure there will be one, it's because of the connotations of the words. Master, of course, could be construed as mastering something, which is exactly what you've done. Mistress has quite a different connotation that we probably don't want to go to. So, yeah, as I say that, I realize that maybe a reevaluation is a little more urgent than I thought.
It's true. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I guess I hadn't even really thought of it in that way, you know, and except that I've never liked the term mistress, probably because of the connotation it has. But I have to say, of all the female leaders that I know of orchestras, I don't know any that go by mistress. I'm not sure. Erin, do you know anyone who actually goes and they prefer concert mistress?
Not that I know, no. And even if you keep going back, and I've had this conversation with Mrs. Falco, with Diane Falco, who is the longtime concertmaster of DSSO, and also who I followed after her amazing career at UWS, and amazing career in both, actually. And I think she too, also, you know, it's the will to not distinguish. It was always, you know, that we're all equal, regardless. Yes. Of identity. And I think that's why we stick with that term. You bring up an interesting point, Robin. It's a really interesting question.
Right. And by the way, Diane Falco is also your mentor, Diane, correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, as Erin was saying that, you know, she was my mentor, my teacher. She still is in many ways. And because I was basically musically raised by a strong female leader, that's just kind of it almost seems strange for me to be anything other than that.
All right. Well, that's what we're going to go with here. So one of the pieces that Deanne will be performing is the Adagio from the Bach Sonata in G minor. You want to set that up for us?
You know, it was really fun for me to record this just the other day. So this is not a professional recording, but we're in the rehearsal and we wanted to have something fresh and new for this broadcast. And so I thought, well, let's go in, and Erin let me into the recital hall, and it was interesting. I had a couple different things I was looking at to maybe put on, and I started recording them, and yeah, they weren't quite the right energy that I wanted. And all of a sudden, what came to my head is I went, oh, the G minor. And as I was playing the G minor, sitting in that recital hall, I cannot tell you when I was at UWS how many hours I would spend in the recital hall and up in that high booth up there, the little recording thing, and I would record and edit my own things. I'd be there at 2 a.m. and playing this G minor brought back all those memories from so many years ago. And I thought, well, this is totally fitting. And it's one of my favorite pieces to play by Bach. I just think it's very calm. And here I am at the cabin. I'm looking at this beautiful lake. And for me, it's just this kind of calm of the early morning, playing some incredible chords. It's so much fun to play. And I hope listen to.
All right. Well, let's listen to it. The Adagio from the Bach Sonata in G minor, performed by Deanne Letourneau. That was the Adagio from the Bach Sonata in G minor, performed by Diane Letourneau. I want to get to a selection by Aaron, but before we do, the last time you were here on that lost episode that has now reached a mythical status, you referred to yourselves as something like sisters from another mister or some similar terminology.
Yes. We call ourselves the Violin Twins.
Yeah.
Ah, better way of putting it. Okay, so are those similarities in repertoire, or is it style or approach?
I'll start this off because I think the very first time we played together, and everybody's like, it would be really cool for you two to get together. So I think I invited you to come play at UWS for our university recital series concert. Mm-hmm. And I remember the very first rehearsal, we were in the ensemble room, and literally we played for about 60 seconds. It was super quick. And we stopped and we just looked at each other because it was like I was playing with a mirror of myself.
Yes.
It's almost freaky. oh my word. I'm like, you're like, we play so similarly, and just approach. And the fun thing is we have like what we call nonverbal cues where you can just like, we don't have to talk about what we're going to do because we're so in sync. Our rehearsal time was cut down pretty significantly because we read each other so well and we have such a similar approach that so much of what we do is nonverbal.
Oh, that literally is exactly what I was going to say. And my knowing of Aaron goes back because after I left UWS, I was at UW Milwaukee for 2 years. And so one of my dearest friends is Pamela Tucker, you know, who was Pamela Simmons back in the day. And she said, oh my gosh, you have to meet Aaron. She said, you two are identical. and then now fast forward years and years. And every summer, I would come home to be at our cabin here because that's where I am right now. And it was always teaching or performing. And so we always missed each other in the summer by maybe a few days or a week, or, you know. And so when Aaron invited me to do this recital, I was so excited. I thought, oh my gosh, we're going to finally meet, not only meet, but get to play. And it was within that first 60 seconds. It was just amazing.
I think if anybody heard our rehearsals, they would be like, I don't understand anything. We don't even have to finish sentences. We're like, we know where the other one is going to go.
All right. Well, Aaron, the selection you're sharing with us is...
This is a sonata by Eugene Ysaÿe. He wrote 6 sonatas for solo violin, and these are very, very, very close to my heart. I've performed all 6 sonatas. I've recorded them, and it was also my dissertation. So they're really amazing, amazing pieces. And this particular one is from the 2nd sonata. And if you recognize something from it, it's because it opens with a quotation from Bach's E major partita. And the other big theme that you will hear in it is the famous Gregorian chant Dies Irae, but it's really, really intricate how he weaves Bach and the Dies Irae in his own voice. It's a pretty spectacular composition.
All right, so here's the first movement, the prelude Obsession of the Sonata number 2 by Eugene Ysaÿe, performed by Aaron Aldridge. Thank you. That was the Prelude Obsession from Sonata No. 2 by Eugenie Tsai, performed by Erin Aldridge. She joins us from Superior with Diane Letourneau. The two concertmasters will be performing at Lucius Woods in Solon Springs tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And joining them for the concert of Pops, Violin Barn Burners, and Stride Piano is pianist Alexander Sandor. Coming up, let's hear what they sound like together. And that flourish one more time. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Erin Aldridge and Diane Letourneau. The two concertmasters will be performing at Lucius Woods tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Joining them will be pianist Alexander Sandor. Tickets are available at lwmusic.org. That's easy enough, lwmusic.org. So, what do you sound like together? Something that all three of you are doing is Jose White's La Bella Cubana. Erin, can you tell us about the piece and the composer?
Yes. I have been doing a lot of research in the last year on underrepresented composers and trying to bring more into the repertoire. So I came across this composer, Jose White, who is Afro-Cuban. And the interesting thing is, especially in the United States, he's just now people are starting to be aware of him. And it's really unbelievable that we're not. And I'm particularly surprised that I didn't know his name, because he was a really big time player. Rossini, the famous opera composer, Rossini championed him and many others. And he was he studied at the Paris Conservatory, and then he was on the faculty. And he taught Jacques Thibault and George Enescu, who are two really important violinists. And I'm so thrilled that he's now starting to gain attention, because he was a brilliant violinist and a wonderful, wonderful composer. And for those of you familiar with violin composers, he's very much like, you know, and around the same time as Wieniawski and Vuitton and all of these really fantastic names. And so I will be playing his violin concerto in February with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra, and that's more of the classical tradition. But I also found this really incredibly beautiful piece that he oftentimes would use his Cuban heritage in his compositions, and this is very much an homage to Cuba, which is La Bella Cubana, and it's just a really beautiful piece for two violins and piano.
All right, we've been speaking with Erin Aldridge and Diane Letourneau, concertmasters both, who will be performing at Lucius Woods, joined by Alexander Sandor, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Information, tickets at lwmusic.org. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And here is Jose White's La Bella Cubana, performed by Erin Aldridge, Diane Letourneau, and Alexander Sandor. Thank you. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Now, a moving story of a family history and family secrets re-examined. It comes from Jim Richardson, one half of the Richardson Brothers team, or can we say local multimedia empire, with his brother, Alan. They're hosts of the Richardson Brothers podcast, which presents stories, some in the style of the late William S. Burroughs, an Amazon.com novella, and a YouTube channel featuring Jim's alter ego, Lake Superior Aquaman, which I'll let him explain. For Father's Day 2020, Jim penned a truly amazing essay on Perfect Duluth Day, reevaluating stories his father told him, among them that their forebears had fought on both sides of the Civil War. Yet after his own investigation, Jim found the family's Confederate ancestry more one-sided than he was led to believe. He joined me in June 2020 from his home in Duluth. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be here.
So, well, maybe you should tell us what Lake Superior Aquaman is first before we get into the more serious stuff.
That's the handle I use as an artist. I do underwater video and photography in Lake Superior, literally dressed as Aquaman, you know, just as a way to brand it as different from other nature photographers around. But that's basically what I do.
All right. So I had no idea that your family hailed from the South. And obviously you're telling us that you had no idea exactly the whole breadth of their history. So tell me first what you were told and then what you found out.
What I was told was my father was a Civil War buff. He died when I was 14. But before he died, he had told me that we had family on both sides of the war. So we have this book it's a hardbound book of 150 pages of family genealogy that was published in 1906. And I've read this book a couple times, but it's so full of historical information that it took a while for this bit of it to shake out in my mind, you know.
Sure. That's really common of anyone who looks at their family history, because the more you find out, the more little scraps of paper or little notes mean.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, I picked this back up recently and thought to myself, well, I'm going to collate all the Civil War information in it and all the slavery information in it, because I knew there was some in there. And what I found out was that the Richardsons solely fought for the Confederacy, were 100% Southern Confederates, and owned slaves as far back as 1730, when the first Richardson set foot on American soil. And so that was mind-blowing, because it meant that my dad had not told me the entire truth, and maybe he was just trying to soften the blow of it for me. I was just a lad when he was telling me this. Mm-hmm. But I can't find a single Richardson above the Mason-Dixon line in 175 years, except for, you know, me.
Well, we'll get to how you got here in a bit.
Right.
When you say that he didn't tell you, or maybe was trying to soften the blow, was that because there was some guilt, or is it possible he simply didn't know himself?
I think it's possible he didn't know himself. There are Richardsons that were not related to, and he may have assumed a relation, but I really don't know. And what I've come to think is that I was so young as he was telling me this, that maybe he wasn't just embarrassed. I mean, we were on the wrong side of this war about slavery, and that's not something to be super proud of. And maybe he just thought that he would soften the blow.
Mm-hmm.
So that I wouldn't feel like we were related to these, you know, literal losers.
And did he make it clear, regardless of what your family's background was, that that was the wrong side? What time period are we talking about?
Oh, well, no, I'm 51, and so he was telling me these things in the 70s. And for all I know, he was not planning on dying early, and that we would continue to have these discussions about family history, and that gradually, I don't know, the truth would out or whatever. I wish I could ask him.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he was just wrong. I mean, I know that he had this book, this family genealogy book, and if he'd read it as closely as I, then he would certainly know, because it's just full of these sons of the Richardsons joining the Confederate Army.
And how is that depicted in the book? 1906, you said?
1906 is when it was published, and
And that's a time post-Reconstruction, the South has re-entrenched itself into white supremacy, for lack of a better word. And this is a very fitting for today because of all the monuments that we're talking about were pretty much erected at this time. Some people think they were erected contemporaneously to the Civil War right after, but actually they were mostly put up after Reconstruction. Your 1906 date perfectly meshes with that.
Yeah, and so the person who wrote it was a Richardson who lived through the Civil War and was bitter about losing it into the 20th century. She died 1907 after writing this family history. And I'm just starting to realize this is a Confederate document through and through. It would be of interest to any historian. I mean, it's chock full of information, even besides the war stuff and the slavery aspect. But you're right. It's timely for me to visit this. And the reason why I wrote the essay was because I'm sick of these guys waving the Confederate flag around in black people's faces and saying, oh, it's my history. It's my, you know, it's my heritage. You can't take this away from me. I'm going to wave it in your face. And to me, that just seems entirely wrongheaded. And given my family history, I've got as much right to wave that flag as anyone and to feel like it's part of my heritage, but I reject it. I mean, they were wrong. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good things you can say about my family heritage, but they were on the wrong side of the Civil War and for the wrong reasons. And it's really too bad, because to me, it doesn't make any sense at all to not be able to admit that when your family heritage has kind of gone awry, you know, I mean, whatever else you can say about these people in the past, even if you can rationalize it like they were people of their time, we still have to be able to say this was wrong. It's no reason to hurt other people by waving this symbol of white supremacy in their face. And that's part of it. It is white supremacy. If you look through this book, the writer gives the reasons for all of it.
And this is, again, tell us what relative, and significantly, is a female relative.
Yeah, her name was Elizabeth Richardson, and I'm still trying to figure out my precise relation to her, and I can't figure out if she's a great-great-great aunt or a great-great second cousin. But regardless, she's an ancestor of mine, and one of the things she says a lot is so-and-so treated their slaves really well. You know, so-and-so's colored people didn't want for anything. Her point of view seems to be, as long as you're treating your slaves good, the Union has no right to take them away. And that's why she was mad about losing the Civil War. And I think that she was basically speaking for the Confederacy in general, you know. She's basically making, like, an apologia for the South and slave owning. Here she writes, from the early 1800s, about Elizabeth Richardson, quote, her colored people were never allowed to want for anything, her well-trained servants doing her faithful service so that everything went on like clockwork in that well-regulated home. She was a devoted Christian.
Do you have another?
I do. So I found that at the family grave plot in Bloom Hill, South Carolina, there are a couple of gravestones for slaves that my family owned. Let's see. Here's one, a slave referred to as Faithful Davy. This says, David, who was born 8th of February, 1747. This is literally his headstone. He served his master, William Richardson, faithfully through the Revolutionary War and up to 1786. And after that, his master's widow and 8 children with the same fidelity to January 1835, when Faithful David died in peace. Near him lies Bina, his aged wife, who also served the same family well for nearly the same time. Their example has been good and profitable on the plantation, and we pray them heaven. And there is another one, too, of kind of a similar character. Honest Jack is his name. And his headstone reads, Honest Jack died 15th of May, 1848, age 77. This trustworthy servant was the friend of his owner and watched his interest as if his own. Ever thrifty yet sparing to himself, he He left $86 laid up from time to time for his widow Sally and their children. Condemn not his example in a lowly agent. High and low in this world are terms of human note. But not to him with whom nothing is great, the nothing insignificant. To all men then must not, this be the important question, have the duties of life as assigned to each station by providence been conscientiously discharged. And so there we see that this bit about the duties of life as assigned to each station by providence, that's the religious rationalization for slavery. Mm. These headstones, these epitaphs are affectionate, but they were also, I think, it's almost like an advertisement, like, you know, be good.
Well, they're written by the slaveholders, so it's not written by the enslaved people themselves.
Exactly. Right. So the whole thing is just kind of dripping with irony and the power relations of it all.
Right. In both of those cases, and I think in the former, Davy, was it? It points out his a rather long marriage, so it seems to imply that he and his wife were not broken up as many slave couples and families were. But again, I think I just answered that and you affirmed it, right? That this was written by the slaveholders. So we have no idea if there was, did they sell some of their children or most of their children or what? We're just getting part of the story.
Correct. And speaking of, there is a part in this family book where it mentions that one of my ancestors at one point went broke from a bad investment, and his home and possessions and slaves were all sold at auction, which means families were very likely broken up. I mean, it's right there, the horrors of slavery and my family participating in it.
Do you have indications that she was not completely telling the truth when she said how well the family slaves were treated?
I don't have any direct evidence, but, you know, here we've got a history of slavery for 135 years, and every time she mentions it, she's like, the colored people were treated great. But I think the chances are 100% that it was not a rosy situation. I mean, for one thing, to be a slave owner, you took part in the process. You didn't just inherit your slaves and not think about it. Like, you had to manage the plantation day to day. You had to punish the ones that were trying to escape or acting out. You know what I mean?
Right. One graphic description, of course, there are many, but I'm taken with the autobiography of Solomon Northrup, which became 12 Years a Slave. And he basically describes the punishments as sort of the whip you would do to a horse to get it to go faster, or indeed a tweaking you would do to a machine, right, to make it pick that cotton faster. So the entire inhumanity is a part of that machine. If you think of them as humans, you can't do it. But if you think of it as just revving up the gas a little bit more, then why, you get more out of those 40 acres or whatever it is.
Correct.
We're speaking with Jim Richardson. He's half of the Richardson Brothers Gonzo Science team, if you will. He has written a really amazing essay on Perfect Duluth Day about his discovery of his Confederate roots, where he was led to believe as a child that his family had been split, one of those cases of a brother against brother in the Civil War, but you found out it was not the case. Where exactly did your family settle? What states are we talking about?
So the earliest Richardsons settled in South Carolina. There's a plantation called Bloom Hill that's on the South Carolina Register of Plantations still, although the buildings are not standing. This was in Sumter County, which to you Civil War buffs out there, you'll recognize it as the county where Fort Sumter was. Those were where the first shots were fired in the Civil War. And this genealogy book documents that there were Richardsons there. And South Carolina was the first state to secede. So really, my family was right on top of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then over time, spread out through the South. So, for instance, my dad's buried in Georgia with a bunch of other Richardsons. and he married my mom, who's from North Carolina. And I was raised in Maryland, which is thought of as a border state, but really slavery was legal there.
Right. Frederick Douglass was enslaved in Maryland.
Yeah. So
even though it was, it did not succeed and was a Union state, but that gets into...
Yeah, so with Maryland, you got these technicalities in there.
Right. What brought you to Duluth?
So I moved all around the country, lived in various places, and finally wound up marrying a Duluth native in California, and she imported me here. Mm-hmm. And when the marriage fell apart, I stayed because... Duluth is treating me so well.
It's the greatest place in the world, right?
It is, arguably. Yeah.
Especially if you want to be Aquaman. What about your brother? What brought him here?
He followed me here after his own divorce as a writing team. We've been collaborating remotely for several years and just wanted to write together, like actually in the same room.
Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to talk to him about this?
Not so much, although we both are well aware that the family is strong on the South. Our relatives are still in the South. So, no, we haven't talked about it directly since I wrote the essay, but mm-hmm. I'm sure he's 100% behind it.
I think I wouldn't be too far afield if I were to say you guys were left-leaning. So would it be a surprise to your relatives that you turned out not to be a Confederate flag waver, or,
The way I would put it is my family was on the right side of the Revolutionary War, the wrong side of the Civil War, but by the time the Civil Rights era came around, we were on the right side again. And there are a couple of Republicans in the family, but for the most part, we lean left in general. And I've emailed the article to everyone in the family, and I'm getting positive feedback. You know, I don't think we're harboring any racists in the family.
Hmm.
There, you know, what I have encountered in a couple of the comments, you know, some people grumble like, well, if I had Confederates in my family, I wouldn't denounce them because the history is just past and it's dead and you learn from it and you move on. But that to me seems like a dodge. Like, here, I've got this information. And I want to face it directly and honestly. And sort of the counterpoint to these Confederate flag wavers, who I don't think are being direct or honest, but it does define who I am and my place in society. I have benefited from the fact that my ancestors got rich on slave labor,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so they have all these generations of rich Richardsons, basically, who are getting rich on the backs of other people's labor, and that did trickle down to me. I mean, not in the way that, like, I inherited any money or anything, but sort of just like all of us descendants had this place in society. So it's this very complicated, tangled history that is not clean, and it's not simple. There's complexity there.
Right.
And as a nation, we still have to grapple with all these details.
Have you found any black Richardsons who would be, there's two ways that they would have a relationship with you. One, simply former slaves or descendants of former slaves who were on the plantation, therefore got the name. Although if they went to a different plantation, as Solomon Northrup recounts, their name would change. So they actually could be from your family's plantation, but you wouldn't know. And
yeah.
Then secondly, blood relatives, because, you know, obviously there's no end of slaveholders who impregnated and raped, for lack of a better word, slave women.
Yeah, I think that's a 100% possibility, given that we're talking about 135 years of slave ownership in my family. That's five or six generations. I almost can't imagine that something like that did not happen. And we know that it was happening, that it was basically, you know, ubiquitous back in the day.
Right.
So
it didn't make it into the 1906 account.
No, and I don't think that should surprise anyone. I mean, it's essentially a cherry-picked account that's an apologia for the Civil War, for the Confederate side, and so it wouldn't have made it in there. but I don't think it would take too much to really find out. I mean, one thing I found is that the online resources for this sort of thing are extensive.
Well, they're exploding, and that's the beauty of it. As we go forward in time in the Internet, it also goes back in time, and you find more and more records. I certainly have in my family. So
right.
You're going to find more and more, trust me, if you stick with it. And the beauty of your 1906 manifesto there, regardless of its intent and its accuracy, is it is cemented in time, and certain facts like names are there that you will find out more and more. You know, all you have to do is stick with it.
Yeah. Without question, already people are sort of coming out of the woodwork in response to it with not only their own stories about the Civil War that have been passed down through their family, but I've already come up with a relative who, you know, we share a Richardson relative back in the past. And so I am definitely, just by accident, have already found someone that's related to me.
Well, when you find more, let us know, and particularly when you find African-American descendants who are related to you. We'd love to hear about that part.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Great. We've been speaking with Jim Richardson, who has written really an amazing essay on Perfect Duluth Day about his discovery of his Confederate forebears. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks a lot.
And that was my conversation in June 2020 with Jim Richardson of Duluth about his discovery of his Confederate ancestors, which he wrote about in an essay for Perfect Duluth Day. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with another local violinist made good, Galen Lee, and her version of Ashokan Farewell. Stay safe, everyone.